Well, I want to welcome Ambassador Thomas Gremminger to this edition of the Public Conversations for the Toda Peace Institute. Welcome, Thomas. Thomas Gremminger joined the Swiss Diplomatic Service in 1990 and served in many different places, posts both in Bern, Tel Aviv, Geneva, Mozambique, and elsewhere, and then served as the deputy head and later head of the Human Security and Peace Policy Division, where he worked in Bern for several years. From 2010, Ambassador Gremminger was the Swiss ambassador to the OSCE, the United Nations and International Organizations in Geneva. And during the Swiss chairmanship of the OSCE in 2014, he played a key role in establishing the observer mission in the Ukraine. In 2017, Ambassador Gremminger was also designated Secretary General of the OSCE, where he served until 2020, giving him a privileged position and view on events in Ukraine and East Central Europe. Since 2021, we've been happy to welcome Ambassador Gremminger back into Geneva, where he is now the Executive Director of the Geneva Center for Security Policy. And part of his role is promoting dialogue and cooperation and track two diplomatic initiatives on various subjects, which I hope we'll be able to touch upon. Let me start with a very broad general question before we dive into some of the details. You can now look back on more than 30 years of a diplomatic career. And from today's vantage point, what are some of the major global shifts that you would say characterize the contemporary situation and characterize the last 30 years of global politics?
I was lucky enough to start my diplomatic career at the end of history, when we came out of the Cold War in the early 90s. You know, the situation was wide open. There was a strong belief, including by all major stakeholders in international cooperation. And I think that very much shaped the first, I would say, at least half of my career. Then depending a bit, you know, do you look at the world and in particular at European security through the lens of a peace and peace and security. Then, of course, I would say relatively early on, around the turn of the millennium, you know, you felt that this spirit of the Charter for European Security started fading, that there was more and more polarization, relations between Russia and the West started gradually turning sour. And I think from that moment on, we kind of were driven again, you know, by the security dilemma in Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian security, and somehow didn't manage to get out of this trap. When it came to more broader issues, I would say this golden age of international cooperation lasted longer. I would say, you know, if I recall the Paris Climate Agreement in 2016, the Sustainable Development Agenda in 15, you know, I would say until perhaps until the start, you know, of the first Trump administration, there was this sense, you know, that many of the global challenges, they would have to be addressed in international cooperation. I think that spirit dominated a significant part of my diplomatic career. Now, obviously, we are in a totally different environment where geopolitical competition rivalry prevails, where we clearly have entered into a multipolar world. That is still very chaotic, where we lack predictability, where we lack clear references in terms of international law, where it seems to have become fashionable again to change borders by military means, and where we see very few positively order-shaping powers around the globe.
So it's interesting that you make a distinction between the beginning of the chill, the end of the honeymoon in the European context, which you trace to the early 2000s, and yet a continued positive environment in the multilateral arena up until perhaps a decade later. Is it just a situation where now the rest of the world is catching up to the European security dilemma, or are these two completely separate tracks, and can we perhaps view them in the future as being a bit separate with the rise of some of the non-traditional powers, or other great powers such as China?
Perhaps the sense of having to address these global challenges like climate change jointly prevailed for longer and became not so early victim of a renewed geopolitical rivalry. And I would also say, that the relation between, let's say, Russia and the West became much more challenging at an earlier stage when, China was, still not, well, hadn't really been perceived, as a as a main rival. I do differentiate between security and perhaps more global political and also development related challenges, where I think international cooperation seemed to have prevailed for much longer.
I'll try and come back to a couple of those themes at the very end, but let's do a somewhat deeper dive into, of course, the one of the big headlines, which is the war in Ukraine. I should say, of course, it's not the only big headline, and you are intimately familiar with all of the other crisis hotspots, whether it's Gaza or Sudan or Yemen or Myanmar. But let's go into a bit more detail in the Ukraine, partly because I know that you are following this very closely and an expert on this, given your previous positions. And a couple of occasions, including, I think, as recently as last January 2024, you described the war as partly as a stalemate and war of attrition that was settling into a kind of a long frozen conflict in a certain sense. Do you still hold that view today? And how do you think the medium-term situation might evolve more or less on the battlefield, because I think that will shape some of the broader political considerations.
I think fundamentally the situation hasn't changed on the battlefield. It's clearly still a war of attrition. You see very little movement. Yes, it's true that was in August the Ukrainian incursion into the Kursk region, but I think without really achieving the effect that Ukrainians wanted to achieve, yes, there is a sense that the military momentum may slightly be on the Russian side. There is some advance in the Donbas, but it comes at extremely high human and material cost. So I think the bigger picture is still very much one of a war of attrition, and the images are still very similar to images that we remember from World War I.
Which is a very sobering thought, in fact, when you see again some of the pictures and images. I know that in a broader context, there are lots of reports that speak about the slow but accelerating bite of sanctions on the Russian economy, the dropping value of the ruble, the high inflation rate, and possible very big stresses in the economy. The expression in French was "pas d'argent, pas de Suisse" at some point, and that if you don't have money, you can't afford to fight the war. And I'm wondering to what extent you think Russia is slowly being ground down on that front, on the sort of domestic, economic and social front.
I think enlightened Russians are aware that their current model of fighting the current war economy is not a sustainable one. And in that sense, when you look into the medium and longer term, I think you can't pretend that time is on the Russian side. In the short term, though, there is a different perception. Clearly, there is the perception that yes, the military momentum is on our side. The economy is booming. In major cities, there is a total denial of the country being at war. So I think there is clearly no sense of urgency on the Russian side for the time being, while I think among the elite there is a sense that this cannot be a sustainable way of running the economy. Running the country in a longer term perspective.
I'm only going to ask one more battlefield type military balance question, and it concerns a couple of the recent decisions to allow both, I think, the Americans, the British, and now the French to allow strikes using their weapons into Russian territory, although it appears with some limitations. Do you think this is going to have either a material or even perhaps psychological impact on the Russian side, and in which direction?
I'm not sure, that it will have a decisive impact. It is an understandable response to an escalation from the other side by bringing North Korean troops to the battle line. And but I think we are still in an escalatory logic. So there is this tit for tat, and that always brings a risk of escalation, of inadvertent escalation. At the same time, I'm pretty sure that the rules defined by Americans and Brits for the use of these long-range weapons are such that the risk of escalation is limited, and from what we are hearing, it's limited to being used in the Kursk region. There remains, I think, a strong concern in both Washington and London, not to a risk an escalation to a confrontation between NATO and Russia.
So, parallel to this, there are periodic calls, some louder than others, to start the beginning of a process of negotiation, whatever that might mean. And I use that term very, very delicately. And certainly, calls for dialogue. And we saw this reflected in Olaf Scholz's phone call to Putin, which was the first one in, I think, a couple of years. Others argue that this is completely premature since Russian war aims have not changed, and certainly neither have Ukrainians. So, what, in your view, would be some of the preconditions for it to be ripe for negotiations, assuming you don't think that now is the right time.
If we follow Bill Sartman's theory, then I think it's fair to argue that for both sides, this mutually hurting stalemate has not been reached yet, clearly. And so that is, I think, also why I would assume that we will see a continuation of high-intensity warfare for quite a while to come. This said, there is clearly an awareness, an increasing awareness in the Ukrainian leadership that time is not on their side, and that at some point they will have to negotiate. And there is, of course, also the assumption that President-elect Trump will much quicker than another US administration would have encouraged or even obliged President Zelensky to negotiate. So I think it is fair to assume that we would see some movement next year, perhaps even early next year. Difficult to say at this point, if on the Russian side there is also a sense of returning to the negotiation table. As seen from a Ukrainian perspective, clearly they would prefer to do that when the military momentum is more on their side, as it is currently the case. And I think that is even more important at the moment when there are solid security guarantees for Ukraine, and that would deter Russia from another attempt of aggressing Ukraine. I think that would make it also, from a domestic point of view, would make it much easier for President Zelensky to return to the negotiation table.
There is, of course, great speculation about what Donald Trump might do as president. And I've heard competing views on this. But one of them is that he certainly likes to win in a bargaining situation. It just depends on what you can define as coming out ahead. And in that sense, what would it take for Donald Trump or for the American administration to want to avoid an Afghanistan type catastrophe where strong support had been provided to a friendly state that essentially collapsed? And I think that might be at least the scenario that will cross the minds of some of the people in the administration.
Absolutely. And this is also an argument that I would use while there is an assumption that President Trump would probably rather sooner than later oblige the Ukrainian government to negotiate. President Trump would want to look like a good deal maker in all of this. And I think here, we have not a very clear sense of what for him a good deal would look like. I think what is for sure, it would have to be perceived acceptable by the Ukrainians themselves. And that would probably imply that Ukraine can preserve its statehood, its independence, its Western European course. And as I said before, it would probably, it would for sure imply be built on strong security guarantees. That is, of course, a question how they could look like. When it comes to the territorial question, I think Ukrainian side would definitely insist that any freezing of the current line of contact would only be of temporary nature and not a final. That is for sure. And also other issues, related to, let's say, sanction relief, reparations, war crime accountability. All this, would at least remain on the table for the foreseeable future. Even though, you might see a cessation of hostilities that is simply building on a negotiated ceasefire, but not addressing all these other settlement-related issues at the same time.
So this sounds like a recipe for a Korea type situation, which of course is one that could last for a very long time. I want to zoom out a little bit now and also take advantage of your deep experience when you were at the OSCE, both as the ambassador and then more importantly as the Secretary General, because of course much of the conversations today revolve around issues of deterrence and defense and strengthening Europe's capacity in the West against potential aggression. But this takes place against the backdrop of, as you said in the very first comments, when there was a European security architecture that appeared to be moving towards a more peaceful set of relations, not just in the Western and East Central part of the continent, but more broadly. And that perhaps is if not the end of a cycle, at least certainly one where we need to start to re-examine some of the central pillars of that architecture. And you have written on the topic of cooperative security in the future European order. So what kind of future does either that concept have of cooperative security or anything related to that? And what kind of conditions do we need to think about in order to be able to go beyond the horizon, beyond what is going to be a war that will eventually end?
I think obviously the kind of end of the war that we will have will shape in an important way any future European security order. But I think it's fair to assume that for the foreseeable future, we will see an order that is marked by confrontation and thereby by deterrence. And there will not be much space for cooperative security in the short to medium term. I would argue that even in the short to immediate term, you would need some elements of cooperative security to stabilize this confrontation. And I would think of crisis communication channels. I would think of some guardrails to make sure that this confrontation, does not escalate, that does not turn hot. But again, I think we won't see a lot of space for cooperative security in the short to medium term. This said, I do hope that at some point, and this of course will also to a large extent depend on Russian policies, I would hope that there is again a space to come back to at least partly cooperative security-based European security order, because it is a more stable one, it's a less costly one, and it would also allow us to much more effectively address other challenges that are not hard security related, transnational threats, global challenges like climate change, etc. All this, is currently attention is so much diverted, and making the international community not being very effective in addressing these challenges. So in that sense, I do hope that there will again be a time for a gradual return of cooperative security. This will clearly depend on the political commitment of the key stakeholders to European security, Russia, but also major Western stakeholders, and perhaps, at some point also non-European stakeholders that are going to play a role in European security. In that sense, we might have developments that are different from what we have seen during the Cold War.
Let me follow that up with, I guess, a conceptual question in a sense. The CSCE, OSCE, Helsinki process had always two kind of tracks that were meant to spill over into each other, and a focus on purely stabilizing the military confrontation in the later stages of the Cold War through confidence and security building measures, and then later building outwards to what was really an expansive agenda of confidence building, including such things as national minorities and respect for human rights, the different baskets. The logic was that these things would slowly advance and that there would be a positive reinforcement and linkage between them. So something went wrong somewhere. Either we were wrong about this logic, or it's simply circumstances that overturned it, whether it's the way in which Russian domestic politics developed or some other situation. So I'm wondering if you think that the logic was still solid and that we can build outwards that way. And also part of that was the idea that deepening trade relations with Russia in particular, but also more globally, was also going to lead to a more peaceful set of security relations. And that seems also to have been called into question, both in the European context and perhaps also with China. So, do we need to rethink how we put all of these things together in a package? And where did we go wrong?
I think, yeah, this is of course a school of thought that is quite prominent these days that basically argues that we did everything wrong, and had we just been much tougher with Russia, this all would not have happened, and we would be much better off. Frankly, I don't believe so. I think we missed many opportunities in consolidating the tools that we applied, CSBMs, but also arms control. Arms control started unraveling basically at the turn of the millennium, with the US pulling out of the ABM treaty. And then gradually, this very complex web of arms control treaties, arrangements, etc., started falling apart. Same with CSBMs. I think these are instruments that still make a lot of sense. I think military transparency will always be key if you want to create a stable security order. But okay, I mean, I was very much involved in attempts to modernize the Vienna document in the years after 2010, and we failed. And I would argue there was neither on the Russian nor on the Western side a genuine commitment to keep these instruments up to date, and the same goes with arms control. And I'm less of an expert when it comes to economic cooperation, but here as well, I would say obviously economic cooperation is not a sufficient condition for stability, but it may very well contribute together with other aspects. And perhaps yet another thought, I also very closely followed Of course, the what we back then called the crisis in around Ukraine, conflict management attempts, and frankly, we've had quite some opportunities to implement the Minsk agreements. This was not done, and it's clearly way too easy to blame only one side for having missed these opportunities, to solve at least one conflict.
So I think there will have to be a lot of retrospective soul searching in various capitals in the West on that question. And I take your point that this may have been not just a question of taking your eye off the ball, but also that people stopped investing in significant ways in shoring up the architecture in a certain way. So that might be a good lesson for the future. I want to ask one more sort of hard security related question before I ask a few questions about your track two and other negotiation efforts. And that is what kind of considerations are going to shape some of the nuclear arms control issues of the future. Because, of course, there is a imminent expiry of the New START agreement in 2026. And at least to my understanding, nothing is happening on any formal or perhaps even informal level to move that forward. And is there any kind of basis for thinking about how we could get to a greater form of strategic stability, especially given the periodic use of nuclear threats right now, not to mention things like force modernization? So these are all, it sounds like the nuclear race is coming back in a sense. And what can we do about that?
Yeah, I'm very concerned about this happening indeed. Look, a lot will depend on will New START thresholds be maintained beyond 2026. I mean, if this is the case, this would be a very significant major constraint against relaunching a nuclear arms race. But we are not sure. So we'll have to see what the new US administration will think about maintaining the thresholds. Then a second aspect, if we see in the foreseeable future an end of the war in Ukraine, that is more or less acceptable, then we may also see a resumption of strategic stability talks. Again, this would probably create conditions to talk about important features, nuclear and non-nuclear. I mean, there is also hypersonic, there is outer space, there is non-proliferation. I mean, you have lots of challenges in the strategic stability agenda. And the fact that there is hardly any conversation between Americans and Russians right now. There is a bit of track two on some aspects of strategic stability, but nothing comprehensive. I think this would obviously help if there was a resumption. And then, of course, the big question linked also with these questions is how to bring China in. Clearly, there is a political pressure in Washington, to be seen bringing China in when it comes to nuclear arms control. I think at the same time, we need to be realistic. This is not going to happen, at least not on a treaty basis. This is not going to happen quickly. So are there ways, to bring the Chinese in by adopting soft law approaches to nuclear arms control? And this, of course, then triggers the question, what would be the appropriate format to discuss such measures? I think you won't see trilateral conversations or negotiations. So would the P5 be the appropriate format? I think there are quite some arguments that would speak in favor of this format. But again, if there is no end of the war in Ukraine, this format will not work very effectively. Right now, it barely works on expert level. And this is clearly not enough if you want to respond to the challenges at hand. And then, of course, there is also the issue of mid-range nuclear weaponry. There is still some sort of an INF moratorium for Europe. Russia threatens to abandon that should Americans station mid-range missiles in 2026 in Germany. Now, if this is, you know, a ploy to launch arms control negotiations, it's all fine. But if it kind of brings us to the end of the INF moratorium, I think this would not augur well. And then the INF issue, of course, is also of relevance in other regions. And again, if addressed constructively, it could provide an interesting way forward in also engaging China. If not addressed properly, it could trigger a nuclear arms race.
No, and of course, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement was actually one of the singular achievements of the end of the Cold War period. So not once did you mention anything multilateral within the formal UN system, with the exception of possibly the P5. And I assume that means you think fora such as the Conference on Disarmament are not, shall we say, the most likely places to see any kind of progress on any of these issues.
Well, the P5 format is a format that comes out of the NPT process. So in that sense, there is a linkage to a UN framework. But beyond, you know, I think there is an opportunity to use the UN more systematically to address linkages between emerging disruptive technologies and security. But again, I think only if key stakeholders, major powers, would allow the UN to do so. And currently, I mean, if you look at the state of the UN Security Council, if you look, you know, at relations between Russia, US, and China, it's difficult to imagine, you know, that this would not spoil also relations in a UN setting and thereby render these formats practically impossible and unrealistic.
So I want to now zoom out even further, because since you took up the head of the Geneva Center for Security Policy post, you've pushed quite hard to encourage track two diplomacy and discussions and informal negotiations. And I guess I'd like some reflections on the balance sheet, if you will, of not just things that you have been directly involved in, but others that you may be aware of. Do we have any success stories that we can build upon? And can we draw some positive messages for mediation and track two diplomacy in general?
Look, at the outset, I would make it very clear. I wouldn't believe or pretend that track two diplomacy can replace or substitute for the lack of track one negotiations. This is simply not possible. But if we are in a situation as we are right now, where on a broad range of very important security issues, there is no track one conversation, not to speak of negotiation. There, I would argue, track two diplomacy can, first of all, simply maintain channels of communication and by doing so prevent the worst misunderstandings and miscalculations. Of course, this is difficult then, you know, to prove, to attribute to specific drug2 platforms. But I think that's something that I've been observing, that this purpose of, you know, simply maintaining minimal channels of communication is a value as such. Then beyond that, yes, I have witnessed now, my center runs for the time being about 16 informal drugs on issues that relate very much to, let's say, geopolitics, strategic stability. We have a number of drugs between Russians and Americans, but we have also started now drugs that facilitate dialogue between Americans and Chinese. We have drugs that have a geographic focus. We work on the Arctic, for instance, the Eastern Mediterranean. So, you know, I would say specifically, I would argue that one of our strategic stability drugs has contributed to producing this US non-paper that was sent to Moscow in mid-September last year. Unfortunately, there was a very negative Russian response, but at least I think it was a track 1.5 that we operated that you know triggered that paper. I would argue that some of our Ukraine-related work has, at least at the outset, contributed to the return of Ukrainian children, to mitigate nuclear saber rattling. I think we have, together with others, certainly also contributed to launching a discussion on creating a contact group of all major key stakeholders on the war. So, you know, I would say there is a track record. And of course, it is also important that when you organize a drug2 platform, that you work with experts that are very close to decision making. You know, if you suspect that this is not the case, then you would have to establish solid bridges between drug2 and drug1. And this is, of course, always a challenge to drug2 work. So bridge the gap, basically, between drug2 and drug1.
So, just from an outside point of view, and perhaps for non-experts, what distinguishes track 2 efforts from what we see is the mediation universe, whether it's informal actors such as the Center on Humanitarian Dialogue or the Norwegians or the Qataris or others, and how do you position this kind of effort compared to, let's say, mediation efforts?
It can be the same. Some of the actors that you just mentioned, they are into private diplomacy, and that is often, you know, preparing the sites for official talks. So that is not really different from what we call drug2 diplomacy. But partly, it's also different because it involves drug2 actors that you know would gather on informal platforms. So in a way, formally speaking, it's a drug 1.5. I mean, for instance, what the Qataris did in trying to get an agreement on protecting energy infrastructures. I think that, in my sense, is perhaps even a confidential drug1 negotiation, you know, based on a shuttle diplomacy approach. So it depends on the stakeholders that you have on board. Clearly, the moment you have government representatives in, the stakes are much higher in terms of, what if it leaks, what if it fails. That's the advantage of a pure track, two track. There is full deniability. If governments don't like it, they can deny it. If it works well, then they can claim success. So it basically track two diplomacy is an ideal tool for governments to manage risks.
I think one of the big takeaways from what you've been saying is that it's twofold, that it's like conflict prevention when it actually achieves something. It's very hard to see the bad things that didn't happen or the dogs that did not bark. And the second is that there is a lot of it going on. Everything from energy infrastructure to grain to repatriating children to other conflict zones around the world. And that's perhaps an encouraging message, at least, that the system is adaptive enough that we're still trying to promote the kind of tools that will mitigate, if not end, some of these serious conflicts. So I think that's a strong message here. I want to now shift backwards in a sense, because I know that one other part of your career was in development cooperation. And you mentioned at the outset that you thought that things like the SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals in 2016, were a major multilateral achievement, and that might be the nearing the end of the great phase of cooperation. We are two-thirds of the way through. I think the SDG commitment was to move towards 2030, and on many of them there has not been exemplary progress, although in perhaps there are some bright spots. And have you followed to some extent the evolution of the development policy frameworks, and in particular the way in which development and security concerns have been brought together? And what are your reflections on how we've advanced on that agenda?
I mean, I must admit I haven't followed it as closely as I would have liked. But still, I think it's the concept, the sustainable development agenda is still a very valid one. The fact that we haven't gotten as close as we should have in implementing this agenda, I think is not due to flaws in the concept as such. I think it's clearly partly due to the crowding out of political diplomatic attention of funding by the geopolitical rivalry, by massively growing defense budgets. So I think there has been a huge crowding out effect in terms of attention and in terms of funding, and that obviously negatively affects implementation. And then of course also leaderships, political leaderships of many countries, more and more resorting to pure transactionalism. Not really believing and investing in multilateral institutions doesn't help either. So, in a nutshell, I think it's not the concept as such that is flawed, but it's lack of commitment by member states. And of course, there is an enormous distraction by geopolitical rivalry, and a lack of also political leadership by major powers. I think that would be my assessment.
So I'm going to close on a question that should be fairly obvious, but you are and have been a Swiss diplomat, both in your career as an ambassador, but also some of your other roles. And I wonder if you can give us some reflections on what you think might be the present and future role for Swiss diplomacy? Is it the same as we've seen over the past few decades? We know that neutrality has been stretched and pulled in different directions, but and that Switzerland's traditional role as a sort of neutral go-between has also been challenged. The Russians have rejected the idea that Switzerland is neutral. There are other players, such as the Qataris and Turkey, that are more active in this. So, what's the particular special sauce or niche that Switzerland can occupy going forward, given its strong, sustained commitment to promoting peace?
I was lucky enough to be part of those Swiss diplomats that had the opportunity to shape Swiss foreign policy as our country came out of the Cold War. And I think a lot of energy was put into creating a toolbox for managing and resolving a conflict. And I think the good news is these tools are still out there. They're still relatively well funded, even though there is also here a crowding out effect to pressures by the defense budget and by also partly the need to reallocate funds to the reconstruction of Ukraine. But still, the tools are still out there. There is a lot of expertise, and there is still, quite a bit ongoing in terms of an active Swiss peace policy. What I would hope for the future is that there is again this strong political commitment that we had at the turn of the millennium, where there was really a strong sense by both the Swiss government, the parliament, but also the Swiss people that promoting peace, managing conflict, resolving conflict is at the core of Swiss foreign policy. And I think here I would, expect again more political commitment to these objectives that are, by the way, part of the Swiss Constitution now. And look, Switzerland's neutrality has been adapted to the challenges of our international environment, but it has not fundamentally changed. It still allows to actually, I would argue, it obliges Switzerland to conduct an active foreign policy. A neutral state in the 21st century needs to be seen as useful by the international community. Only then neutrality makes sense as perceived by the international community. So I think there is still there are expectations, but there is also a space for Switzerland to assume an active role in promoting peace. And this also pertains to the perception by those that seem to be, if you believe their public narratives, skeptical, as for instance the Russians. I think when it comes to differentiating between more and less unfriendly countries, we are still in a category of the less unfriendly countries. And I think there is still quite some trust out there to assume roles in facilitation. And I do see that through the work of my own center. I think from the fact that we are based in midst of international Geneva in a neutral country is very very important for the credibility of our track to work that we do.
So, a last personal question. You recently received an award congratulating you on your many contributions to peace promotion and diplomacy and Western values. And I recall that one of the things you said was that you didn't feel that you were finished. that this was not the ultimate end of your career. So what's next for Ambassador Thomas Gramminger?
For the time being, as long as I'm at the helm of an organization that can offer informal space for dialogue, I will certainly continue to do that. If there are other challenges coming up in international affairs, promoting peace and security, I'm still I still have lots of energy and I have 35 years of expertise that I'm willing to make available.
Well, I certainly, and I'm sure many others, look forward to seeing where this journey takes you. Thank you for a magisterial tour of the horizon, actually. We touched on a very wide range of issues, which I think illustrates very well the depth of your experience and expertise. And again, thank you for participating in this public conversation for us.